four chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is relevant for us because just now Gaur Purnima was there, soon after that Ram Navami is there. So it talks about the appearance of the Lord in this world. The fourth chapter is titled by Srila Prabhupada as Transcendental Knowledge. In the Mahabharata standard edition that is there, it is titled as Jnana Karma Sannyasa Yoga. So if we look at the third chapter, that is titled as Karma Yoga. Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita also has the same title. The fifth chapter is called as Karma Sannyasa Yoga. Prabhupada makes it more specific, Karma Yoga, action in Krishna consciousness. So the fourth chapter focuses on giving transcendental knowledge in a systematic way by which one can actually practice Karma Yoga with a deepened conviction. So there are many parallels between the third and the fifth chapter. In fact, the starting questions of Arjuna at the start of the third chapter, 3.1 and 2 and 5.1 are very similar. And Krishna's answers are also similar, but Krishna's answers go deeper into the philosophy. And that depth of philosophy comes because of the systematic philosophical understanding that is given in the fourth chapter. So, the fourth chapter has five divisions. The first section, verses 1 to 10, talks about transcendental knowledge means knowledge about Krishna. Transcendental knowledge, now there can be knowledge about Brahman, about Paramatma, about just the soul. But here when Krishna is talking about transcendental knowledge means knowledge about Krishna. Then from 11 to 15, Krishna is describing how he is the creator and the goal of all paths. Krishna is the creator and the goal of all paths. So there he will talk about demigod worship. He will talk about Varnashram Dharma. And he explains that ultimately he is the creator and he is the goal of all these paths. Then from 4.16 to 4.24, Krishna talks about how to perform Karma Yoga, because this whole chapter is about getting Arjuna to fight. In fact, that is the whole purpose of the Bhagavad Gita, but to fight in divine consciousness. So in Karma Yoga, the yoga is the divine component. So how to perform Karma Yoga? Now there Krishna concludes by talking about how yoga work can be a form of sacrifice. So from 4.25 to 4.34, he talks about different sacrifices to acquire knowledge. What are the ways in which we can perform sacrifice? For example, one form of sacrifice is doing fire yoga, but giving charity, doing pranayama. These also involve sacrifice of immediate pleasures for a higher purpose. So Krishna gives a very broad, generic definition of sacrifice there. And he explains the ways in which sacrifice can be performed. And from 4.34 onwards, 4.34 to 4.42, which is the last section, the glory of transcendental knowledge. So 4.34 is the most often quoted verse in this chapter, along with 4.7 and 8. That is Tadvitti Pranipatena. So after we get knowledge from the spiritual master, what is the glorious effect of that knowledge? So today we will focus on the first section, 4.1 to 10. Now the third chapter ended by talking about how one can conquer lust by recognizing oneself to be transcendental. 3.36 to 43 talks about how lust attacks us and how we can counter lust. So one should acquire higher intelligence. That was the concluding verse. Evam dhe param budhva samsthabhyatmanamatmanah jahi shatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasatam. That's why your intelligence. Evam buddhe param budhva. Understand yourself to be transcendental. And jahi shatrum. Conquer this enemy of lust. So then in the next chapter, Krishna says that it is not just I am telling you to use your intelligence to conquer the enemy of selfishness and lust, but I have created a whole system of transcendental knowledge since time immemorial, by which it is not just the individual but the society that should be organized in a way that people can be saved from bondage to lust. So he starts with the fourth chapter. So how we will do this is we will recite the verse together, and then one can read the translation, and then I'll discuss briefly on the verse. So let's start with the 4.1 together. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavanahamavyayam Vivasvan Manave Praha Manurikshvakave Bravit. Yes, translation.
The personality of Godhead, Lord Shri Krishna said, I instructed the imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivasvan, and Vivasvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed to Ishvaku.
Yes. So, this knowledge is right there from the beginning. But the sun itself is the source of illumination. Krishna is telling that actually I am the source of the illumination for he who illuminates the whole world. There is one illumination of physical life, another illumination is the illumination of wisdom. So, the Surya Dev, like in the Gayatri Mantra, when we chant, Savitra refers to Surya Dev. Of course, we understand that in the planet of Sun God, there is Surya Narayan and we are praying to him. Generally, Surya is also considered to be the source of wisdom. So, Krishna is saying, I give wisdom to the sun god who gives illumination. So, Imam Vivasvate Yogam, this yoga, this knowledge of yoga, I gave it to him. Proktavan aham avyayam. And you don't think at that time this knowledge started. Actually, this knowledge is eternal. Avyaya. Avyaya means eternal. It is eternal, but it was manifest in this particular creation at the start of the creation when I gave it to the sun god. And then, the sun is a celestial being. How did it come on this earth? The sun's sun, S-U-N, S-O-N. So the sun's sun is Manu, Vaivasvat Manu, Imam Vivasvate Yoga, Proktavanaham, okay, Vivasvan, Manave Praha. So Vaivasvat Manu brought this knowledge on the planet earth. And Manur Ikshvakave Bravit. And then he gave it to his son Ikshvaku. Now Prabhupada goes into a lot of details, talking about the age and the dating in the purport. That is technical, but it is self-evident, so I won't discuss that too much. But the point is, even from a material point of view, the Bhagavad Gita is ancient, very ancient. You know, one scholar of religion, he compared the various religions in this world. Even if we don't accept the Vedic literature's account of themselves being millions of years old, even from the historical point of view, you see, he says that actually, Islam is just like a fresh teenager and Christianity and Buddhism are slightly older teenagers, and he says Judaism is like a fresh middle-aged man, but Hinduism is the grand old wise man. So he says that even from material point of view, the Vedic knowledge is the most ancient. But its glory comes not just because it's ancient. Its glory comes because it is comprehensive. It is systematic. It is practical. So here, Prabhupada in the purport explains that actually for the systematic advancement of society, the main obstacle is selfishness. And the main expression of selfishness is lust. So to save people from bondage to lust, it is for the responsibility of the heads of society to organize society according to knowledge, culture and devotion. Knowledge, culture and devotion. So knowledge means, what is the goal of life? What is the ultimate objective that one is to achieve through one's life? Without knowledge, people will just keep pursuing mundane pleasures. And it's not just knowledge, because we may understand that yes, life is meant for spiritual purposes. But if the whole society around us is aggressively materialistic, it becomes very difficult to practice spiritual life. So therefore, there has to be a culture. And if we see when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu descended in Navadvip, there was knowledge. There were very great pandits, Trivedis, Vedis, Chaturvedis, and there was culture also. know, they used to respect Brahminical culture, they used to protect cows, but there was no devotion. So knowledge and culture are meant ultimately to bring about devotion. And when this three combination is there, knowledge, culture and devotion, then one can conquer lust. So knowledge and culture bring us to the mode of goodness. And devotion takes us beyond goodness to transcendence. And then we can break free from the pulls of lust, which primarily comes from the modes of passion and degenerates as wrath into the mode of ignorance. So in our devotee life also, we acquire knowledge by studying the scriptures and we try to develop a culture. The culture involves waking up in the morning and dressing in a particular way, taking only prasad, food that is prepared to be offered to Krishna. And we interact with a respectful and honest separation among the genders. And this sort of culture helps us to practice the knowledge. And along with that, we do explicitly devotional activities, which engenders the bhaktilata in our heart. And then gradually we can go beyond the pulls of lust. And now Krishna tells in the next verse how this is not just one ancient instance of how knowledge was given, but this is the standard way in which knowledge is passed down. Let's recite the next verse. Evam parampara praptam imam raja rishayo viduhu sakaleneha mahata yogo nashtah parantapa.
The supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciple succession, and saintly kings understood it in that way, but in course of time the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost.
Yes. So evam parampara praptam. This is one of the most important verses for understanding how to understand Bhagavad Gita. Many people think that just open the book and study it, we can understand it. No. You know, in philosophy, one field is called as epistemology. Epistemology means knowledge about knowledge. For example, in our Discover Yourself course, session 2, where it talks about Pratyaksha Anuman Shabda. What are the different ways of acquiring knowledge? So that chapter is from, in philosophical terminology, called as epistemology. So this section is about the epistemology of the Bhagavad Gita. How is Bhagavad Gita to be understood? And that's why Srila Prabhupada in these purports systematically refutes the modern approach to Bhagavad Gita, where one just becomes a scholar and tries to study and analyze. He says, no, evam parampara praptam. In this way, in parampara, this knowledge was understood. Imam Raja Rishayo Viduhu. So by the saintly kings. So there are in Kali Yuga, there is no Rajarshi Parampara available. We have the four Paramparas which are mentioned in Padma Puran, and they are the sources of knowledge. Kalauya Bhavya Utkale Purushottama. That if you want to develop bhav, attraction for Lord Purushottama, then Kalau. In Kali Yuga, these four sampradayas are only the means. So Parampara and Sampradaya are more or less similar words. But Parampara refers to one particular succession. For example, Prabhupada was one disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, and Prabhupada had as many disciples. Now we are connected with Prabhupada through our spiritual master. So our parampara will be our spiritual master, Prabhupada. But Prabhupada has many disciples, and the whole branching of all the disciples along with the successive disciples is called as Sampradaya. Sampradaya is the whole lineage, and parampara is one particular lineage within the sampradaya. So Krishna is telling, in this way, by parampara the knowledge is passed on. But sakalene hamata, by the great power of time, mahata means great, by the power of time, yogo nashtaha parantapa. Oh Arjuna, you are the great conqueror, parantapa, but time is a greater conqueror. What happens by time? There is addition, there is deletion, there is modification. So, and the knowledge gets changed. So, there is addition, deletion, modification. And that's how, now, nashtaha means destroyed. Prabhupada translates nashta as appears to be lost. Actually, the transcendental knowledge is eternal. It can never be destroyed. But what is destroyed is its accessibility to us, our chance to benefit from it. And that's why it appears to be lost. So nashta has used more in the metaphorical sense, not in the literal sense that the knowledge is destroyed. Because knowledge is eternal. It cannot be destroyed. And then in the next verse, he says that in this way, when the knowledge is destroyed, it is Krishna who is concerned that the souls in this world, without the knowledge, how will they be able to understand and achieve the goal of life? And therefore, he considers it his responsibility to provide this knowledge again. And therefore, he's telling Arjuna, I'm not just telling you to fight for utilitarian purpose, because I want the kingdom to be won. I want actually to revive this knowledge once again. And he says, I'm giving you this knowledge. And he tells what is the qualification of Arjuna for which he is getting this knowledge.
Yoga prakta puratana bhakto sime sakha cheti rahasyam hi etaduttamam.
That very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you, because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and can therefore understand the transcendental mystery of this science.
Yes. Now Srila Prabhupada repeatedly translates yoga as science. Now, from a Sanskrit point of view, yoga as science may seem a little objectionable. You had a vigyan or some more accurate word. But Srila Prabhupada wants to differentiate very clearly that what Krishna is giving is not just another religious system. It is actually a system of personal transformation. It says we have material science, which can manipulate and transform matter in the external world. So there is spiritual science of yoga, which transforms consciousness in the inner world. And it's a systematic, universal, time-tested process. And that's why it's called a science. So eva yam maya tedya, into you. Yoga prokta puratana. Puratana is ancient. So earlier also, avyayaha. So that is very ancient. I am giving it back to you again. Why am I giving it to you? Bhakto asime. Because you are my devotee. Sakha cheti. And you are engaged as my friend. Rahasyam. Secret. Confidence. Etat uttamam. Uttamam means the best. Uttama also means, tama is darkness. Uttama is that which takes one beyond darkness. So this rahasya, understanding it, will take you beyond the darkness of material existence. So now, non-devotees can also study Bhagavad Gita. But their study is clinical. And that's why they don't understand the heart of the Gita. A simple example to understand this. When I use the word clinical, if a mother has a child who is sick and that child is taken to a hospital, to a clinic. Now, the doctor there may do a systematic testing. Okay, what is his blood count? What is his weight? What is his height? What is his acidity in the stomach? We also study what is the composition of his stool and urine. Now, he knows a lot about the child. But does he know the child? Because he's approaching the child as a biochemical unit to be analyzed. He's not approaching the child as a person to be loved. Now the mother, she may not know anything about the blood count and the stool and urine composition, but she loves the child. Why? Because she's approaching the child as a person. So non-devotee scholars, they may have a lot of precise information about Krishna. You know, this particular book, this is said about Krishna. This particular book, this is said about Krishna. They have a lot of precise information. But their approach is clinical. Clinical means they study Krishna either as a mythological person or as a historical person, just about whom we want to compile information. But Krishna is not mythological, and Krishna is not just a historical person. He is the supreme person. And as a supreme person, we approach him to love him. So that's why know, there is a difference between knowing about God and knowing God. Knowing about God means we get a lot of information about a particular person. But knowing God means we know the person. So, that's why Rahasyam Yetat Uttamam. Bhagavad Gita can be understood only when we approach Krishna with the intention to serve and to love. Otherwise, it is a rahasya. It is a mystery. Now, when Arjuna heard Imam Vivasvate Yogam, I spoke this to Sun God. Arjuna immediately got a question. How could you have spoken to Sun God? You know, we are equals. We are born at the same time. But Arjuna doesn't ask the question immediately. It's not a second verse that immediately is asking question. Because many times when we have a question, the question may itself be answered in the future course of the discussion. So he waits and watches. But now he sees, oh, subject is changing. I am going to be given the instruction. I had better want to know how this instruction is authentic. So therefore, he said, pause. Wait, Krishna, I have a question. And next verse, he asks Arjuna. So let's recite the next verse.
Arjuna vacha aparam bhavato janma param janma vivasvatah kathametat vijaniyam tvamadau proptavaniti.
Arjuna said, the sun god Vivaswan is senior by birth to you. How am I to understand that in the beginning you instructed this science to him?
Yes, so Arjuna's question is permeated with a very positive, learning, submissive attitude. Katham etad vijaniyam? How am I to understand? He's not like, Krishna, you are bluffing, you are lying. How can you have given this knowledge? Not possible. He says, no. See, he gives a logical objection. But he doesn't say that this logical objection proves that you are false. He says, because of this logical objection, I can't understand it. See, the Bhagavad Gita doesn't teach us that that we have to throw aside our intelligence in order to accept a spiritual path. No, we have to use our intelligence. In fact, that's why Krishna spoke the whole Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. But at the same time, the intelligence has to be utilized in a submissive way, not in a skeptical way. So yes, now if you can use our intelligence, you can try to understand logically why do certain things happen. For example, you know, we can say that if God exists and God protects people, then why does the tsunami kill so many people? So this is a question with the intention to learn. Whereas somebody says, if God existed and he was meant to protect people, where was that God when thousands of people were killed? Obviously there is no God. So there are questions to know about Krishna. And there are questions to avoid Krishna. So many times behind the letter of the question is the intent of the question. So those who ask questions with the intention of avoiding Krishna, many times followers of the Semitic religions means Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Judaism. So these people, they try to, their intention is to destroy the faith of the followers of the Vedic path in their culture and their philosophy. Because they at least start by asking questions, what about this? And basically most followers of the Vedic culture today know no philosophy. I just ask them a few troubling questions and people just get the faith. So when people ask questions also, we have to see what is the attitude in which they are asking questions. And we need to explain to them that, yes, questions can lead to the growth of knowledge when there is the willingness to learn. But if there is the intention to defy, then questions cannot lead to the growth of knowledge. So, katham etad vijaniya? How am I to understand that actually both of us, you know, the sun god is long ago, aparam bhavato janma, param janma vasvata. But he is older than you, so how can I understand that you have given knowledge to him? And then Krishna answers with the next verse.
Shri Bhagavan Vacha Bahuni Mevyati Tani Janmani Tavacha Arjuna Tani Aham Veda Sarvani Natvam Veta Parantapa.
The personality of God itself, many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of enemy.
Yeah. Yes, bahuni me vyatitani, vyatitani. Many words we have passed, but I can remember them. Now, here, as in the earlier verse, Krishna uses the word parantapa for Arjuna. Parantapa is one who actually gives, you chastises the enemies. So he is a chastiser of enemy, but there is the enemy called time. And the time causes forgetfulness. So you are overcome by forgetfulness, Arjuna, but I am not. I remember everything. So here is the difference between the living entity and the Supreme Lord, very clearly illustrated. All of us forget our past lives. Now, why is it that we forget and Krishna remembers? That he describes in the next verse. Ajo pisanavyayatma bhutanamishvaro pisan prakritim swamadhishthaya sambhavamyatma mayaya.
Transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every realm in my original transcendental form.
Yes. Aja. Aja means unborn. Now, unborn doesn't mean non-existent. If somebody is unborn, you mean that he doesn't exist only. No, unborn indicates that he is beyond the scope of time. He within time there is birth and there is destruction, but he is beyond the jurisdiction of time. That is the meaning of unborn. The word born is generally used in terms of beginning. When he says unborn, that doesn't mean non-existent, but it means beginningless, beyond the jurisdiction of time. Aja is an avyayatma. Avyayatma is also imperishable. So the first line of this verse describes attributes that apply to both the Supreme Lord and the ordinary living entity. We are also Ajaha, we are also Avyayatma, we are also imperishable. But the next line describes the difference. Bhutana Ishwaropisan. Ishwara is the controller, Bhutana. All living entities, the Supreme Lord is the controller of all living entities. And then Prakritim Swam Adhishthaya. Prakritim Swam, by his own nature, Adhishtaya, he comes. Sambhavami Atma Maya. Again the same, Atma Maya, by the internal potency, by Yoga Maya, he appears. So Krishna is telling that actually when I come in this world, I come in a nature, in a body. The body is made of nature. In a nature that is derived from my internal potency. So Krishna comes in a spiritual body, not a material body. So this is one of the great perplexities for all philosophers, whether Eastern or Western. You know, if God comes to this world, then how does, if he comes in a spiritual body, how does he interact with this material world, which is made of matter? And how does he interact with ordinary people who have material senses? In fact, this problem has been the bane of Christian theology. Because Christians, to some extent, consider Jesus to be simultaneously human and divine. Now, although Jesus said, I am the Son and I have been sent by the Father. But because he told practically nothing about the Father, so Christians have made him equivalent to the Father. And that's why practically they worship Jesus as if he is God. And they say that the Father, the Son and the Holy Spirit, they are one and the same. And they worship Jesus as if he is God. But the question arises, which their philosophy find is very difficult to answer. How is it that, you know, when he comes into this world, how does he interact with people of this world? Now, yes, we have physical body, material body. Now everybody else around has material senses. So how can, now we can't see the soul if you put a microscope in the heart. So because it's spiritual, not just because the soul is so small, but because it's spiritual. So if somebody comes in a spiritual body, how can anybody see him? So Srila Prabhupada explains that Jesus is actually Shakti Avishavatar. He is an empowered living entity. And when he came with a body that was made of material elements. Just like when we say that the spiritual master's body is not material. What does that mean? That means it is not used for materialistic purposes. It is made of material components. But it is not used for materialistic purposes. So there is something called material and spiritual by composition, and there is something called material and spiritual by application. So the deity or the spiritual master's body, they are spiritual by application. They are not spiritual by composition. They are not made of spiritual elements. Now the spiritual master's body is also made up of earth, water, fire, air, ether, but it is spiritualized. So that's how Jesus' body was. Now Jesus' body changed. You know, he's a small baby, then he grew up and he became middle-aged, and then he was crucified. And crucified, and he died a painful death. So the standard understanding is that Jesus, you know, when he was dying, he was completely fearless. And he forgave them, for they know not what they do. But that is told in one of the Gospels. You know, in, I think Luke, it is said that he said like this. But in Matthew, it is described that, you know, he was very fearful and in great pain. And then finally, after hours of the nails piercing in his body, then finally he said, "Oh Father, why have you forsaken me?" And he died. So now, that's why when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Kazi are talking, there Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that in the Yavana scriptures, there are many contradictions and mistakes. And Prabhupada elaborates, the Yavana scriptures means, it refers to the Old Testament, the New Testament and the Quran. There are many mistakes, contradictions and illogical points. And the Kazi says, yes, I know this. But because it is my tradition, I accept this and continue. So there are serious contradictions like this. But the point is that how does, if the Lord come in this world, how does he interact with this world? That's our essential discussion over here. So it's explained, actually Srila Padre Ramanujacharya analyzes this very elaborately in his Sri Bhashya. Sri Bhashya is his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And much of what our Goswamis talk about is derived from the Sri Sampradaya. We often take many of the principles established by Ramanujacharya. So, how does God come into this world? We say God comes in a spiritual body. Yeah, that's obvious. But then the question, if he comes in a spiritual body, then how can people with material senses see him? Isn't it? So then the explanation is that God is omnipotent. So when he comes in this world, normally speaking, he does not defy the laws of this world. Normally speaking. Because, you know, he can exhibit his omnipotence and defy the laws of this world. But his purpose is not just to defy the laws of this world. His purpose is to exhibit his pastimes and attract people back to him. So, by his yoga maya, he not only comes in a spiritual body in a material world, but by his yoga maya, he also gives people with materialistic senses the vision to see him. But that is not an upgradation of the vision, because to ordinary people, he appears like a materialistic person, only, material person with a material body only. Yes, he's very handsome, very powerful, very charismatic, but he appears to be like an ordinary person. That is, that does not require that the Lord have to have a material body. But that is the interface. You know, God is unchanging, but his energies are changing. So Krishna, when he comes in the material world, he comes in the same self-manifested, eternal, two-handed, flute-holding form. But when he comes in this world, his prakritim swamadhishtaya, his energy creates all the interactions by which people in this world can see him and think of him as material if they want. That's why Maya Ashitana Nardarakena. Now Shukadeva Goswami, when he's observing the Gopas playing with Krishna, is telling Parikshit Maharaj, don't think these are ordinary children. Ittam satam brahma sukhan bhutya dasyam gatanam paradaivatana Maya Ashitana Nardarakena sakam vijaru krita punya punjaha. He says, Ittam satam brahma sukhana bhutya. Here is that all-pervading Brahman whom the impersonalists aspire for. Here is, for the yogis, he is who? He is paradaivatanam, dasyam gatanam paradaivatena. For those who want to serve him, he is the eternal master. Mayashritanam naradarakena. Naradarakena, just ordinary living entity for those who are in maya. So Krishna arranges that extremely dynamic system by which the conditioned soul can see him and still not see him. Pashyat apina pashyati. He sees him but does not understand the truth about him. Thinks about him to be just an ordinary living entity. And now, after describing in this verse the mechanism by which he comes, briefly he describes it. This verse has literally been the territory for wars to be fought, intellectually. You know, between the Advaita Sampradaya and Advaita Sampradayas. So Shankaracharya interprets this verse to mean that actually Krishna comes under Maya. Krishna comes under Maya and he assumes the form of Maya. But Prabhupada systematically refutes that based on the previous Acharya's commentaries. So, now after describing the mechanism in which he comes, we can't go into all the subtleties of what all the Acharyas have discussed, because that it will require not one class, it will require several classes to understand the arguments itself. And then we have to understand how they are refuted. So, in the next verses, Krishna will describe why he comes. When he comes, why he comes. So, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyuttanam adharmasya tadatmanam srujamyaham.
Whenever and wherever there is decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata and the predominant rise of religion, at that time my descendant myself.
Yes. Yada yada. Whenever and wherever. Sometimes when two words are used, the words may be same, but their connotation may be different. Yada yada, it's not the same. Whenever and wherever. Dharmasya glanihi. And there is dharma glani. Now what is dharma glani? Dharma glani is not just that, okay, this particular dharma goes down, that particular dharma goes down. It means, you know, in general, people's knowledge of dharma gets lost. So people start emphasizing materialism over spirituality. That is dharmasya glanihi. Tadatmanam srujamyam. So it's very dynamic. As soon, it's like a wing balancing. As soon as one side goes down, the other side will automatically go up. So as soon as dharma goes down, automatically the dharma will go up. You can't have anything in between. There may be some in-between phase, but individually, person is going this way or that way. The transitional phase is very transitory. It's very temporary. So then Krishna says, I descended that time. And what do I descend for? To restore dharma. Now dharma is a very profound concept. Dharma refers to the underlying order of this world. The underlying order and harmony of this world. Now, even modern scientists are surprised by what they see in the universe around them. We see, if you look at the history of the Western world, how atheism and skepticism spread. It was more because of disillusionment with the Christian understanding of God and to some extent the atrocities of the church. So many of the popes were like parallel kings and they were quite violent, well documented history. So people were disillusioned with the prevalent ideas of God and that's why they turned to skepticism and atheism. And unfortunately, even now, the only two alternatives which people have for knowing about God in the Western world is Christianity and Islam. And it's like trapped between the devil and the sea. Christianity is bad and Islam is worse. So it's fanatical. So that's why people don't have a systematic understanding of God. So it was interesting that as science studied itself more and more, advanced more and more, many people feel that it was the advancement of science that led to the refutation of religion. But no, science revealed actually more and more the order that is there in the whole world. Whole cosmos, as we know, right from the microscopic level to the macroscopic level. There is systematic order in the world. So, in one sense, the planets follow their dharma by moving in their orbits. Dharma means their nature, their duty, their function. The electrons follow their dharma by going around in their orbits. So now, where do we see chaos? We see chaos at the human level. We see chaos at the human level, isn't it? So many people killing and so much greed, so much violence, so much sexual abuse. So actually, for even the animals in the lower species, they follow their nature. For a tiger, its nature is to catch a deer and eat. It follows its nature. So for the lower species and for the insentient matter, it follows its dharma naturally. But for human beings, it has to be a conscious act of the will, a conscious act of volition to follow dharma. So dharma means the order that underlies the universe. And the universe works according to its order, but we human beings need to consciously choose to participate in that order. So our dharma is Jivera Swarup Hoy Krishna Ritya Das. Now that's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Jiva Krishna Das, Ei Vishwas Korle Dwara Dukkanai. See, he says that if you just accept this fact that you are the servant of Krishna, there will be no more misery for you. Now how is it possible that there is no more misery? Still, the world is going to be filled with tsunamis and earthquakes and cyclones and match fixing and everything else like that. We are going to go old, get deceased and die. But you know, the suffering in this world comes because we want to be the controllers. So when we want to be the controllers, we are not following our dharma. If we just accept our dharma that we are the servants and then we change our attitude, Krishna, how can I serve you in this situation? That question itself will lead to a great peace of mind and will lead to a guidance also. How can I move forward in life? So when Krishna comes to re-establish dharma, that re-establishment of dharma is not in the animal species, it is not in the motion of the stars, it is not motion. Now to some extent may appear that why is the tsunami coming chaotically and destroying people like this? But that is because we human beings are not following our dharma, so there is a reaction which comes from nature. So the root is our own misdeeds. So when Krishna comes to this world, he comes to guide people how to gel in, how to harmonize with the order of the universe. And that he will describe in the next verse.
Paritranaya sadhuna vinashaya cha dushkritam dharma samsthapanathaya sambhavami yuge yuge.
To deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants as well as to re-establish the principles of religion, I myself appear, millennium after millennium.
So now if you understand this meaning of dharma, the underlying order of the universe, then we can see what is happening. Actually, the word dharma comes from dhru. Dhru means to sustain. Dharayate. So dharma is that which sustains the universe, sustains everything in the universe, practically speaking. So now, there are people who are trying to follow dharma, but they are fearful. They are oppressed. They are persecuted. So, to deliver them. Paritranaya sadhuna. And then, those who are disrupting dharma, what do I do? Vinashaya chidushkritam. I destroy them. So Krishna, even when he kills the demons, he does not kill them with a sense of vengeance or revenge. He kills them with compassion. Because in this particular life, their minds are so possessed by adharma that they cannot harmonize with the order of this world. Therefore, the only way to purify them is to surgically separate them from their sin-contaminated bodies and give them a new body where they can have a begin in a new way. So vinasha chaturskritam. So this vinash is not out of cruelty or revenge or vengeance. This cruelty is out of, it's also out of compassion. It's going to benefit them. And dharma samsthapanartha. And by doing these two things, by delivering those who follow the order and destroying those who disrupt the order, what do? I establish the order once again. Dharma samsthapanarthaya. And the last part of this verse is very popular in India. Sambhavami. Yuge, yuge. In fact, it is the second most popular verse fragment of the Bhagavad Gita. The first most popular verse fragment is Karmanneva Adhikaraste. Just do your duty. These two verses are used by people to avoid surrender to Krishna. Karmanneva Adhikaraste. Just say, do your duty. You know, in the Vedic tradition, there is what is called as Ardha Kukutnyaya. You know, half and logic. But these verses demonstrate not half hand logic, quarter hand logic. You take one fourth of a verse. So, Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. This is the favorite verse used by anyone who wants to claim that I am an avatar. You know, God keeps coming in every yuga. So, in this yuga, I am the avatar. Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. There are so many people in India who claim to be avatar, and they all quote this verse. So, Sambhavami Yuge. There follows also upon this verse. So of course we had the drama Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. So that verse fragment is known very well, but it is generally misinterpreted in this way. But you know, if somebody is claiming to be an avatar, there are several factors which have to be considered. There has to be scriptural prediction, there has to be extraordinary bodily features, there has to be unparalleled performance of feats, and there has to be a specific mission to be achieved. So in that way, it's not just anybody and everybody who can claim to be out there. Yes, there can be great people who can do great things. And from the ordinary point of view, these people are extraordinary. But that doesn't mean that they are avatars. You know, from the, even at the time of Krishna, Arjuna was an extraordinary warrior. Nobody was equal to him. But nobody considered Arjuna to be avatar. Yes. You know, the extraordinary person doesn't mean that he is a supreme person. That is a mistake in India. Just because somebody can do something which we can't do, that means he is God. No. He may be extraordinary in a understandable sense. Like Sachin Tendulkar is called the God of cricket. You know, yes, he may have some extraordinary talents. But there is nothing miraculous about it. That's just, he has a particular kind of... Now, he himself doesn't know. Sometimes he is out of form. How can God go out of form? That means he's not the absolute supreme controller, isn't it? Every time he would like to score a century, but he cannot. So there was so much as anticipation that he will score his 100th century, but he could not, isn't it? Even in front of his home crowd, he could not go. So he's not the supreme controller. So yes, now somebody may have extraordinary ability in a normal sense, or somebody may have extraordinary ability in a supranormal sense. Supranormal sense means somebody may be able to walk on water, somebody may be able to lie down on nails and still not have his body pierced. But these abilities, whether they are extraordinary in a normal sense, now normal sense means what? Yes, other people also have talent in batting, but not as much as this particular person. But it's not supernatural. Although some may be supernatural, but even if it's supernatural, still that doesn't make one God. God is a completely different category of existence. Now, sometimes scientists argue, or philosophers and scientists argue, that you may say there is order in this world, but ultimately there is disorder. Yes, ultimately there is disease, there is death. So, how is there order in this world? Actually, yes. Ultimately, you can say there is disorder in this world. But the disorder itself is a part of a higher order. The disorder is a part of a higher order. What does that mean? That means, just like in a prison, if you see, there is reasonable comfort, a reasonable facility provided for the prisoners. There is food, there is clothing, there is shelter, there is medication available if required. But still, there is austerity, there is suffering. So, the always design has to be evaluated in connection with purpose. When we try to evaluate design separate from purpose, then we can always fault the design. For example, if we take a mobile, and you know, if I want to type a whole book on a mobile, what a useless keyboard. This designer is so stupid. Can't you understand that you need space to type, to place the fingers? How can you type? Such a stupid mobile designer. No, you have to evaluate using not just the design criteria, but the purpose criteria. A mobile is not meant for primarily type. It is meant for communication, and secondarily, it can be used sometimes for typing. Isn't it? So if you want to type a book, you have to use a separate computer. So design has to be always evaluated in connection with purpose. If you don't know the purpose, then any design can be faulted. No matter how good a design you make. You take a very high class laptop, and then you're using it. This laptop, the screen is so small. You can have a giant screen, but then it will no longer be a laptop. You'll need a table to keep it on. So every design has to be evaluated in connection with the purpose. And the problem with the atheists, when they try to prove that there is suffering in this world, so there is no God. Now they are disconnecting the purpose from the design. The purpose of this world is not to provide us a happy place. The purpose of this world is to provide us a transitional place by which we can return back to the spiritual world. So the design of the jail has to be evaluated in connection with its purpose. Like, you know, the Bangalore temple, they started doing food for life in one of the jails in Bangalore. And, you know, they were giving pulava and pakoda and puris in jail. And what happened? The prisoners were not ready to go out of jail. And many times, even if a prisoner was thrown out of jail, he would commit a robbery and just wait in the place of the robbery to come and be arrested. Then the prison authority told, don't give such opulent food to the prisoners. Give some simple food. So, actually, if you give opulent food to the prison, then it defeats the purpose of the prison. The purpose is people should get reformed and get out. So like that, the Krishna will not provide abundant facilities for material enjoyment in this world. And this is not a flaw in the design. In fact, this is the purpose of the design. So therefore, Krishna comes to establish order in this world, but that order is ultimately meant not to become comfortable in this world. That order is meant to become purified so that we can return back to this world. And that's why in the next verse, Krishna will tell the real purpose why he's coming. The real purpose is coming is not just to establish order in this world. The real purpose is to attract us to come out of this world back to him.
Janma karma cha me divyam evam yogeti tatvata tyaktva deham punar janma naiti mameti so arjuna.
Translation: one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in the material world, but attains my eternal reward, Arjuna.
Yes. So, Janma Karma. The purpose why Krishna comes in this world is to exhibit his appearance and his activities. And they are divya. They are transcendental. So, one of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, Kalakanta Prabhu, he has written a book on poetry. So, first he wrote a book on the Song of Divine, a poetic rendition of the Gita. Now, he's done a poetic rendition of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And he's titled that as A God Who Dances. So there was Friedrich Nietzsche, a German philosopher, who got fed up with the Judeo-Christian idea of God as one, as a person who is stern and strict and throws thunderbolts in the sinful and sends them down to hell. So he said, you will have to sing better songs if you want to me to believe in God. He said, I would believe in a God if he knew how to dance. So unfortunately, there were no Hare Krishna devotees to tell him about a God who dances at that time. But, so they have taken that theme, a God who dances. And there in this book, so I had the opportunity to edit that book for him. So he writes, even if you think from an objective point of view, Krishna surpasses any character, whether historical or fictional. You know, Krishna's activities, whether you take Superman or Batman or whoever, you know. Even if you want to take from a fiction point of view, Krishna's activities are fantastic. You know, you go up a mountain and jump down 88 miles. Even Spider-Man doesn't do that. So, anyone, you know, Superman, Batman, nobody has 60,000 wives. So, even from the point of view of extraordinariness, Krishna surpasses any character, historical or fictional. And then he explains the six opulences in contemporary terms. He says, Krishna is a person who is more powerful than Schwarzenegger. He is more wealthy than Bill Gates. He is more intelligent than Lincoln. He is more beautiful than ... whoever it is. And on top of that, he is more renowned than Mother Teresa. So, the idea is that even from a material point of view, whatever people are attracted to in material, among other materialistic people, Krishna has it far more. So, Krishna's real purpose in coming to this world is to reveal his all-attractive personality and nature. Evam yoveti tattvataha. So, the crucial thing is to understand him in tattva. Many of us in India suffer from the I know disease. I know disease means, yes, Bhagavad Gita, I know already. Krishna, I know already. But from childhood I know. Yeah, but actually, our I know is the main thing that stops us from knowing. Why? Because we know Krishna mostly as a, you know, maybe we know Krishna because our grandparents used to tell us some stories about Krishna in childhood when we were sleeping, or we saw some Ramayana and Mahabharata. So we treat Krishna as an entertainment character. So that is, so without the tattva, Krishna is amusing. With tattva, Krishna is amazing. You can be with amaze. That's why Srila Prabhupada, when he went to the West, and even when he came to India, he presented philosophy systematically to help people understand tattva. And then when they are attracted to Krishna, their attraction goes very deep. And that attraction is life transformational. Many traditional followers of the Vedic culture may have an attraction to Krishna, no doubt. They may offer bhoga to Krishna, they may release Krishna as pastimes. But how much does the attraction transform their lives? Free them from material attachments? Not much. Because tattvataha understanding is not there. If we get tattvataha understanding, if we understand philosophically Krishna's position. So the important thing is that with respect to Krishna is first we have to understand the position and then we have to understand the person. But unfortunately for most people, they first look at the person and then how can he have a position? Now suppose a tribal comes from a nomadic area where there have never been any surgeons. And he hears, you know, a surgeon is a person who can cure big, big diseases. And he's so, you know, he has such great skills by which he can cure diseases which are otherwise incurable. And then he comes and looks at a person and he says, you know, okay, you're taking him into operating theatre, and he takes out a knife and he cuts his stomach. And he says, hey, call the police, he's committing murder, he goes and tells his relatives, hey, you know, he's committing murder over there. And then nobody takes him seriously. And the person comes out, hey, he's murdered your relative, punish him. Instead of punishing him, he says the relatives, go and pay him. He says, what stupidity, don't you have any intelligence? No, you know, you have to understand the position of the surgeon first. And then understand the activity. So like that, you know, people think of Krishna. He dances with other men's wives at night. How can he be God? And then on top of that, you know, you people, you say you're worshipping God, your God is enjoying and you are being brahmacharis. What nonsense! So, they can't understand anything. No, because first understand the position. Then you can understand the activity. That's why tattvata is so important. And that's why Srila Prabhupada's Krishna book is magnificent. Because he gives the pastimes, but he intersperses his philosophy. Wherever people can misunderstand, Prabhupada clarifies and helps people to gain the right understanding. And if we understand him in this way, then we will return back to him. And in the next verse, he concludes the section by explaining what it takes to come back to him.
वीतराग भय क्रोध मन्मया मामुपाशितः बहवो ज्ञान तपसा भूतामद्भाव आगतः.
Being freed from attachment, fear and anger, being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, many many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me and thus they all attained transcendental love for me.
Yes. So there are many quarter verses in the Gita which are repeated. For example, Vitaraga Bhaya Krodha. This comes at 2.56. Dukkheshana Dvignamana Sukkheshana Vyataspura Vitaraga Bhaya Krodha Siddhir Muniruchyate. Like that there are many phrases which come again and again. Now here, Prabhupada explains this Vitaraga Bhaya Krodha in a very beautiful sense. So he says, let's go over this verse. Manmaya, you have to fix your mind on me. Maam upashita, and fix your mind me, not in the clinical sense, but in the sense of taking shelter of God. Maam upashita. You know, many people think Krishna is an interesting person, but he's a mythological person. Well, if he's mythological, then it is illogical to take shelter of him, because he doesn't exist only. So the whole purpose of studying Ramayana and Mahabharata gets defeated if we consider Krishna as mythological. So we know Krishna, fix our mind in Krishna in such a way that we can take shelter. Maam upashita. And Krishna says, if you do this like this, Bahavo, many people in the past, jnana tapasa, by the austerity of knowledge. That means this knowledge, acquiring this knowledge is austerity. But if you acquire this knowledge, puta, you become purified. Madbhava Magataha. You come back to my abode. Srila Prabhupada takes this word bhava to mean bhava in the nine stages of bhakti. And then he explains the nine stages of bhakti. Adau, Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha. And how you can come to the bhava stage by knowing about Krishna. So, but the important thing that Prabhupada focuses on the purport is Vita Raga Bhaya Krodha. So, three factors that obstruct us from knowing Krishna and turning back to Him. So, first is Raga. Raga is attachment to this world. The Sanskrit Raga and the Hindi Raga are different. Hindi Raga is Krodha, anger. Sanskrit Raga is attachment. Of course, one Raga leads to the other Raga also. Attachment will lead to anger eventually. So, Raga. So, when we are too attached to this world, and maybe God exists, maybe there is some more, there is His happiness, or there, but you know, I am also happy over here. You know, I am okay, you are okay. Prabhupada said, this is not our philosophy. You know, our philosophy is, I am okay, you are not okay. Why? Because I am serving Krishna, you are not serving Krishna. So some people say, okay, God is happy there, I am happy here, let Him stay there, I will stay here. No, if we have attachment to this world, then we cannot turn towards God. So raga, attachment to the enjoyment of this world is the first obstacle. And that's the obstacle which captures most of us. Then there is bhaya. Bhaya is fear. Fear, what fear? Because there are some people who get fried out with material life. And the main source of frying out in material life is relationships. We have some ambitions. We have to develop some relationship with some people and we get frustrated. And then for such people, see, the Vedic literature is so accommodating that whatever way you can turn towards the absolute truth, that's wonderful. So there seem to be a lot of verses which talk about impersonalism in the Vedic literature. Why are they there? Because many people who get frustrated with material life and material relationships, if they are told in spiritual life also you have to develop relationships. I don't want it. It's too much, you know, developing relationships. I can't do that. Better let me forget spiritual life. No, now they have got one step in going towards spiritual life, that is becoming frustrated with material life. So now let them not get frustrated with spiritual life also. Get a misunderstanding which frustrates them from spiritual life. So therefore for them, there is an impersonal understanding. Oh, there is Shanti. So peace. Oh yes, I want Shanti, you know. This person says this, that person says that. Person. Spiritual life is Shanti. Yes. So it's not that the Vedic culture's conclusion is impersonalistic. But there are a lot of people who turn to spiritual life because of frustration. And Vedic culture expands itself to accommodate them in its fold. And that's why there are many impersonal sounding verses. So bhaya refers to, so somebody may become spiritual but not devotional. Spiritual means going beyond the realm of matter. But devotional means developing a relationship with Krishna. So that is also another obstacle for coming towards Krishna. We become spiritual but we have a fear of spiritual relationships. Then that bhaya will be an obstacle. So raga refers to the materialistic people. Bhaya refers to the impersonalists. They are obstructed by bhaya. And then there is krodha. Krodha is anger. Now this anger is not just anger because of frustration with sense gratification. This anger is a different kind of anger. It is a frustration with the inability to find the right spiritual path. That means somebody says, okay, I want to know about spirituality, but so many different philosophers, some philosophers say this, some philosophers say that, some philosophers say that. What is the truth? So confusing. Just forget it. Don't get into it. So actually, skepticism is the most common thread of thought in modern philosophy. Because whatever you take, whatever philosophy you are presenting, you can always find faults with it. This is wrong. Now skepticism has one great limitation. It can tell you what is wrong, it can never tell you what is right. So now, it's like a doctor. It's like a patient. If he is sick, and if he wants to be skeptical, you know, he can challenge every doctor's diagnosis. You know, this could be wrong. Yeah, everybody can be wrong, but the problem is that you will stay in the wrong sense of it. You'll be sick. So, you know, skepticism is to some extent useful. You should not be gullible and fall prey to anyone and everyone. But if a person is perpetually skeptical, such a patient can never be cured. That's why those who resort to skepticism, Prabhupada says, no, skepticism is also rascaldom. Materialism is rascaldom. Just because I can't know something, that means there is no truth to be known. That is skepticism. So what we have to understand here is that, like, once Prabhupada was in America giving class, I think in New York. So Prabhupada gave his talk, and then one young man stood up. Swamiji, I think your philosophy sounds like Buddha's. So Prabhupada said, do you follow Buddha?
Yeah.
He gave a little surprise. Well, no, Swamiji, Prabhupada said. That is the problem. He says, you people don't follow anyone. He says, follow Krishna, follow Buddha, follow Jesus, follow someone. Don't just talk. That's why, don't just talk. You know, because somebody is following someone. If you follow a doctor, you know, if the doctor is good, you will come to know he's good. If he's bad, you will come to know he's bad. But if you don't follow him, you will never come to know anything. So like that, if somebody takes up a spiritual path, he will come to know whether it is right or wrong if he follows it. Of course, there is one danger over here. One danger is that many times when people take up a spiritual path, then they follow it not to know the truth, but to prove that they are true. You know, now I am following this path, therefore it must be true. How can it be false? So if one has that motivation, then one is lost. But then one is not following a spiritual path, one is simply following an egoistic path. That my ego wants to prove that my path is the greatest. That's why the real test, the purpose of spirituality is not so much to prove as to improve. Not to prove, but to improve. You know, if we can improve our own lives, that will be the greatest proof for people that our path is right. On the other hand, we may logically argue and do so many things. But that is prove. Our path is right. A person convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So unfortunately, many people get into this trap. And that's why religious conflicts takes place, because people are not trying to improve, but they are trying to prove. So if we improve, now of course we have to prove so that people will start improving. But you know, our purpose is not just to prove. Our purpose is to prove and to improve. Prove so that they can improve. And this twofold objective in mind. That's why we should always, whenever we preach, we try to engage people practically in some way. Try to get them to do some seva, at least do the seva of taking prasad. You know, they do some practical activities, transforms their lives. Get them to chant some Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So that way, when they do some service, they experience the benefit. And if one is truly a seeker in this way, one is not trying to prove, but one is trying to improve, then one will never succumb to growth. Because you will understand, yes, I will not be, if I don't find the right path, then it is I who suffer. So finding the right path is my responsibility. This is just like we see in Journey Home. You know, if you think from the simple logical point of view, a person coming from America who doesn't know anyone in India, how can he possibly find out a guru and find out a path? How can he find out right guru and the right path? You know, India is a country with 1 billion people. How do you find out? Nobody has a stamp, I am a guru. Or too many people have a stamp, I am a guru. Whichever you want to put it. How do you find out? But Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Vriddeshi Arjuna Tishtati Brahmayan Sarvabhutani Yantra Arulani Maya. The super soul is guiding the wanderings of all living beings. So I'll conclude with this. Once there was a Mahasatsang program in Thane, so Radharaj Maharaj is giving that. So one person asked Swami, how can we know there are so many teachers who claim that they are genuine? How can we know that who is genuine? So Maharaj gave a beautiful reply. He said, he did not go into logical analysis, this path is right, that path is wrong. He gave a simple reply. He said, don't bother asking about the question, who is genuine? He said, ask the question, are you genuine? Are you really interested in finding out the truth? If you are genuine, it is God's responsibility to take you to the genuine path. But if you are not genuine, then this is the world of cheaters and cheated. There's so many people who will mask our pseudo-spiritual motive, our materialistic motives in the garb of pseudo-spirituality, and will pretend that I am spiritual, but we are just being materialistic. So this krodha is a great obstacle in modern times. Actually, we are not living in modern times. Now it is called postmodern times. So everybody's opinion is right for them, and there is no absolutely right opinion. That is postmodern thought. So krodha is the defining syndrome of this postmodern age, but it doesn't lead to any good. You can understand what is bad, but you cannot understand what is good. To understand what is good, we have to practice. And Krishna reassures Arjuna, bhavo, many people in the past have become purified, O Arjuna. And you can also become purified. And you can return back to my abode. So thank you very much. श्रीमद् भगवद गीता की श्रील प्रभुपाद की गौर भक्त वृंद की ताई गौर प्रेमानंद Good question. Very intelligent question. The question is that if Arjuna is already a devotee, then he doesn't really need spiritual knowledge. On the other hand, if somebody needs spiritual knowledge and they cannot get it without being a devotee, then what is the hope for them? So here, so the word devotee can be defined in various ways. You know, there is a very strict definition, there is a universal definition, there is a liberal definition. So strict definition, you know, for us, devotee means Hare Krishna devotee. You know, we say something like that. But in a more liberal sense, we can say anybody who believes in a personal God and wants to serve that personal God is a devotee. That's in a more liberal sense. And in a more liberal sense, we can say every soul is a devotee. And even now they are serving Krishna, but they are serving Krishna through Maya. So the word devotee has many different connotations. So when Krishna is using the word over bhakto sime sakha cheti, he is referring to not somebody who is necessarily a practitioner devotee, but who has a devotional attitude. Devotional attitude, not a skeptical attitude. Yes. That's why in the end of the Bhagavata, Krishna says that idam te na tapaskaya na bhaktaya kadachana cha shushrushave vachyam cha mam yogasuryate. He says that don't give this knowledge to those who are envious of me. So, in one sense, all of us are envious of Krishna. That's why we came to this material world. But there is implicit envy and there is explicit envy. Implicit envy means that yes, we all want to be enjoyers. But explicit envy means, you know, we want to deny God's position and we want to assert God's position. So somebody is not envious in that sense. Okay, there is a God and I want to serve Him, I want to know Him. Actually, the Prabhupada writes in the preface of the Bhagavad Gita that the truths of life are very simple. But false commentators mislead people away from these simple truths of life to complex world jugglery. But so it's simple. It's actually very simple to understand that, you know, God is great and I'm small. And I'm meant to serve God. See, when I have this basic attitude, that is good enough. So here, the devotee means that devotional attitude. Okay? Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.